Hi, listeners. You can now listen to this community podcast production ad-free on Apple Podcasts and access the podcast 1 week early and get exclusive bonus content. Just hit the subscribe button now on Apple Podcasts. Or if you want access to all of the above, plus video versions of the podcast, head to patreon.com/stopthekilling.
Stop the Killing is proud to be supported by our sponsor, Easy PA. Easy PA is an integrations-capable communication software that connects older building systems, such as signage and public address systems, to modern software technologies, such as panic alarms and mass communication systems. Go to easypa.com, that's EZYPA.com, to learn how to integrate your systems today.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
I'm Sarah Ferris, true crime podcaster.
And I'm Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
And you're listening to Stop the Killing. Hello, everyone. A quick note before today's episode. Just wanted to give a shout out to our newest Patreon member, Jim Cipollini. Like all our Patreons and Apple subscribers, we cannot thank you enough for your support of the podcast. It really does help fuel our mission to stop the killing. And if you want to support the podcast, you can go to patreon.com/stopthekilling or simply hit the subscribe button on the Apple Podcasts app when you go to show. And if all that is in the too hard basket, just click the links in the show notes below, wherever you're listening to this. Now, this is part two of The Anatomy of Terror, a look at the Oslo bombing and the subsequent shooting on the 22nd of July 2011. In the first episode, we covered the attack, which involved a car bomb explosion near government headquarters and a subsequent shooting spree at a youth camp on an island. This episode, we're going to pick up where we left off, delving into the mindset and motivations of the perpetrator, highlighting the extensive preparation he made. So let's get into it.
This is very much political violence. And I will say that overall, this is the deadliest mass shooting that has ever occurred on Earth. And that is striking. And that's why other shooters admire him. Isn't that sad? He was very much a believer in a Christian nation. He was a white supremacist and he becomes very obsessed with it. So then it becomes easier for him to say, and I'm going to be part of the solution. And that is where his perceived grievance with his country and the world begins to turn to action. And he begins to plan years ahead of time. He doesn't know exactly what he's planning for, but he's planning for something. I mentioned that he had a truck bomb with a ton of fertilizer in it, 2,000 pounds plus 950 kilograms. In order to get that amount of fertilizer, you know, it's fertilizer that's used in farming. This guy creates a company, moves to someplace, and begins purchasing fertilizer that he keeps in his storage building, which everybody knows. They interviewed neighbors and they're like, oh yeah, he keeps all that fertilizer in his barn. But he's a farmer. So he creates this image that he's a farmer and he can legitimately buy all this fertilizer and nobody will know the difference. In the United States, we had a fertilizer bomb that blew up one of our federal buildings. And so now that's what we call a tripwire. If you buy fertilizer, we're going to look into whether or not you're actually using it.
It obviously didn't trigger anything. How long ago was that from the date of the bombing?
So we're talking 2 years before. We established this company under this fictitious concept of cultivating vegetables, melons, roots, and tubers. But in fact, what he wanted to do was he wanted to obtain chemicals and not just fertilizer. He tried to obtain a lot of other chemicals. He thought about the idea of inventing a gas or poisoning people. So he started this business in 2009. And it was just basically this cover story for him gathering all these things, which maybe he hadn't quite figured out exactly what he was going to do with them, but he was busy formulating a plan because this is pretty much all he was doing. This bomb that he made that was like a ton. So that would be like 2,000 pounds of fertilizer. They had records that he had purchased 13,000 pounds of fertilizer. That is a lot of fertilizer. The neighbors knew he was storing it in this barn. And so they thought, well, okay, you know, he's a farmer. He created a company website with fake employees. This guy had nothing to do but to create havoc, and not just like to create havoc down the road. He was just like inventing a world that didn't exist.
So that's the thing when you talk about the psychologists, the forensic psychologists or psychiatrists that go in, it's just like, wow, what a job to work out whether someone's mad or bad.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Because if you think about that, about him, let me give you some examples of the stuff that he did ahead of time on, like, is this guy criminally insane, right? Like you said, mad or bad. Is he criminally insane or not? Here are some of the things that he did in preparation for the shooting. He hollowed out the inside of one of his cars so he could amass the weapons that he needed to do this task, right? So he hollows out the back of his little, you know, Hyundai. And yeah. He gets a prospectus for a mineral extraction business printed, which was supposed to give him an alibi in case somebody suspected him of preparing for a terrorist attack. Right. I mean, this guy is thinking 1,000 reasons. You know, you work a lot on fraudsters. They're always positioning themselves to have an excuse for their conduct. And that's what this guy did.
But the difference, I think, often with the fraudsters is it's very reactive. Like, they'll come up with a story because they're being pushed. This guy's like thinking steps ahead.
Way ahead. Years ahead, right? Years
like thinking ahead. Of problems that are yet to even really.
Right. They haven't happened.
No, exactly. Whereas the fraudsters are kind of like, oh shit, the heat's on. Mm-hmm. Now I'm a spy. That's why that's happened. Like they're reactive.
No, that's true. That's true. I know some people would say, well, all that ammunition and guns, how does that happen, right? That's another thing. How does that happen? This guy had the ability to get a hunting license. He wanted a pistol also. But his intent really was that potentially he could have homemade hand grenades and things like that that he could use. He was like any kind of mayhem that he could cause. That was his plan. And he wanted to get like a AR-15 style or AK-47, which is a military style weapon. So he wanted some assault type rifle. He had fake police badges printed. He had this law enforcement uniform that he purchased. He wanted to get firearms illegally in different places. He tried to get them like in the Czech Republic, and then he couldn't, right, get them there. So
small mercies.
But actually, the thing is that he tried to obtain weapons in Germany, in Serbia, right? And so he decided, okay, well, fine, I'll just get them legally. I mean, I've sold guns to people in the backs of cars. There's plenty of guns available, but he couldn't get those. So he's like, well, I'll just get them legally. So how do you get a gun legally there, right?
Yeah.
So he came back to Norway and he got a legal permit to buy a semi-automatic carbine weapon, a .223, which is a big round. If you were looking, the round is like the size of your finger, your index finger. And it's for hunting deer. So he got a legal permit to purchase this gun, which he bought in 2010. Right? 2010.
Which all fits, right? Because he's got a farm.
He's got a farm. Like, you know. Right. Exactly. So this guy had plans, right? He was just going to buy all these illegal guns and he was going to use that to get his, you know, his ammunition. And then he was going to commit these horrible crimes. And then he couldn't. So he decided, fine, I'll just go the legal route because he has no criminal record. He does the interviews. He does whatever needs to be done. And he legally gets a hunting license and two guns, a 12 gauge pump action shotgun. 308 and bolt action rifle. And he does, in fact, obtain a legal permit for this semi-automatic carbine, that's the 223, which I know is all like gun talk, but gun people know what that is. And so then he's like off to the races, right? because he's got this plan underway and now he's executing this plan.
He's got to get lots of ammunition, though, because he's there for 90 minutes. So
that
hasn't tripped anyone up either, clearly.
No, but you know what? The regulations on ammunition is a more of a challenge because of the different regulations, the ability to obtain. And we see every shooter has lots and lots of ammunition. They acquire it in different places. They borrow it from friends. I know a guy who, during the pandemic, had thousands and thousands of rounds of ammunition. And people were so freaked out that, I don't know, they thought the whole world was falling apart. They were buying guns and ammunition, and he was selling his ammunition to other people. I mean, it's just craziness. I mentioned that he was getting these long guns, but, you know, he wanted a pistol also. And since it's harder to get a pistol in Norway, he had to go to class.
Like a firearms training thing.
Yeah, he had to go to pistol class, right? It's harder to get pistols. In Norway, he had to prove his regular attendance at a sports shooting club. That's where you use a pistol.
Just so much layers and layers on this. I'm just so curious to know, like, who was around him watching this unfold? Like, what was his job? How did nobody spot all of this?
Well, exactly. I mean, it is kind of a, like, what, right? He belonged to the Oslo Pistol Club, and he went to 15 training sessions. He bought magazines, he bought rounds. So he also, because he was at this pistol training center, he was able to buy ammunition. And not just like that was the only place, but, you know, you go different places, you buy your ammunition. And so he begins to acquire, and this shooting happens in July. By mid-January, he has his approval to buy a pistol. He is out the door and he buys that pistol. Remember I mentioned that he had like grandiose plans? They also find out that he had purchased sodium nitrate, which he could use to poison people, kill people.
He's covering all bases.
He's covering all bases. I'm going to blow people up. I'm going to poison people. All right. So let me back up two steps. One is, you hear me say all the time, video games, you know, stop focusing on video games. Well, one of the reasons why we hear people say, well, video games, is because when this loser committed this attack, one of the things that he said is, oh, he played video games like Call of Duty and, you know, stuff like that. And he did that, you know, kind of sharpen his instincts and his tactics and stuff. So then that became another calling card of, oh, people who play video games, they must be these violent offenders.
Did that reinforce an already thought of sort of myth, the game playing kids in the basement, or is this where it came from?
I think this is the primary place where it came from. Every shooter after this was measured by, did they play video games? You know, and that's a long history of it. There were certainly ones before.
Yeah.
But when this guy who was alive, right? A lot of our shooters die. This guy is alive and he has prolific writings.
Yeah.
And braggadocious this and that's that explain how good he was and why he was so good. One of the reasons was, you know, I practiced in video games too. And I used, you know, the World of Warcraft, and I learned my skills and tactical blah, blah, blah. Your tactical blah, blah, blah was murdering a bunch of teenagers standing in front of you, buddy. So not a lot of tactical skills there.
No.
So, you know, just one more reason why he was just saying how, you know, oh, this was so cool and I did these cool things. No, not so much cool. But, you know, shooters, as we know, they want to say, right? They want to say that they're cool. Let me say this about him and his background. I think the fact that there is not really a ton of information about this individual is that he led a quite unspectacular life. And he wanted to invent one, be famous. And he says that, you know, in his writings. And he does that with his actions of posting on YouTube and sending out emails with his missives and bragging about his political philosophy. He wanted to be a player in the game of, you know, what is the idea for my nation? And he was so far from that. You know, plenty of people play politics. He wanted to be somebody.
It's just sitting with me, that line that you just said, that he had an unspectacular life.
I think that's who he was. I think he was not satisfied having to be that person. So he invented a different person that he could be.
An unspectacular life that spent 2 years planning this.
Yeah. I mean, and years prior to that, developing hate.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't just arrive at, hey, today I'm going to plan this.
I've worked white supremacist cases, especially as an agent. I found that sometimes people who espoused what appeared to be a particular political position, in fact, were people who were leading incredibly unspectacular lives. They had plowed through high school and maybe had not even had any further education. By the time that they get to be in their 20s, they're working someplace or they have kids, maybe that they didn't want, and a job they don't like, and they really want to have a different life. And so they go out searching for it, just like a 13-year-old searches for a gang to belong to because they feel like they don't belong in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting how these individuals just accepted that as a particular belief because they wanted the people standing next to them to like them. That's not really who they grew up being. I mean, certainly there are people who grew up, right, in a family that is very strong position about, you know, ethnic cleansing or other horrible things. But a lot of times the people who I worked were people who maybe couldn't hold down a job. Maybe they had a job that was mundane and they had no particular future that they were planning. They couldn't see beyond today.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they were happy to catch on to a philosophy just because they wanted to have something else to think about.
It's like religion. It's like cults. It's like anything. It's that somebody's given you a framework that you can then hang your life on without having to create that framework. And people around you believe it.
Yeah, actually, I think that's a great point. And I think who around you doesn't have a framework, those people are more vulnerable. Those are the people who are more brittle. They don't have something around them who is continuing to guide them in the principles of morals or ethics.
And now a word from our sponsor. EasyPA is an integration-capable communication software that connects older building systems, such as signage and public address systems, to modern software technologies, such as panic alarms and mass notification systems. Additional features include built-in automated bell schedules, remote access, text-to-natural voice announcements, and custom audio playlists. EasyPA is one of the only full-service public address and communications companies that has in-depth knowledge on both the hardware and software aspects of communication and evacuation-based products. As a solution-based company, they offer design, supply, installation, and maintenance of all their products. And for use in schools, EasyPA software provides multi-zone capabilities, pre-scheduled daily announcements and bells, and a remote alert button that can be accessed from anywhere in the school. Once a panic alarm is triggered, law enforcement is notified immediately. EasyPA makes schools safer from any threat. Go to EasyPA.com, that's EasyPA.com, to learn how to integrate your systems today. If you want to be a reseller or integrations partner, visit EasyPA.com to learn more. That's EasyPA.com.
Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this, tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal, because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
You know, we mentioned earlier that he had his particular political belief, but basically he was anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant. He doesn't seem to be pro anything, except for he wanted a Christian nation. His own writings claim that he had tried to contact people, you know, in government to push through these thoughts or those thoughts, and they didn't take him seriously. And one of the things that I know from being, you know, in the FBI and law enforcement knows this is that, you know, people come to your door and they talk to you about something. It's the tip of the iceberg. They may have so much underwater that you can't see. You have to be really careful. There's so much more to their messaging than the five sentences they say to a law enforcement officer at the door. People who are around brittle individuals like this shooter, oftentimes we find they don't see things because they become acclimated to the behaviors and the language and the hatred or the lack of connection with people. But those are the people who are best able to see somebody who is sliding downhill. Because it does kind of beg the question, okay, this guy's kind of non-existent in the world. What is going on in this company? Who is looking at this company? Who lives nearby? Who is he interacting with on a daily basis? I mean, there's so much that's not answered, even with what is, in fact, the most horrific shooting event, a day that changed the history of Norway forever. We have to be aware of whether there are people around us who, because they are unsatisfied with their unspectacular life, are thinking about doing something to be remembered.
What did justice look like in this case then, if he was alive?
So the subject in this case, the shooter in this case, the bomber in this case, was in fact charged with two counts of terrorism and first found to be not sane, couldn't stand trial, then found to be legally sane and could. And in fact, in the end, he was convicted of both terrorist charges and he was sentenced to 21 years in prison, which seemed like nothing in some ways, but 21 years in prison, but with extensions that can be added at a minimum of 10 years. So he's not going anyplace, but that's, you know, kind of how their legal system mets out punishment.
Well, how does that compare to the US for terrorism charges? I mean, obviously there's a scale.
Right. I mean, even we have a shooter in the Detroit area who killed four people in Oxford High School, and he was found guilty of terrorism. And those are 20-year charges. So 20 years is kind of fits into the ballpark. You can bet that this guy in 2023, 2024, 2025 is still sitting in jail, possibly writing and espousing the same hate. You know, because he spent clearly a decade doing it before he committed this crime.
Yeah, exactly. The Christchurch massacre. Did he inspire one, or what do you say?
We see in some of those subsequent shootings, we see this subject's name.
Yeah.
Like etched onto guns or mentioned in subsequent manifestos or missives or writings or slurs of vile wording. But a lot of times when we see somebody who is wanting to become famous and that's their main priority in life, they can say whatever they want. But the bottom line is they want to be famous and it has nothing to do with their political position. They just want to be famous. And if they just want to do it because they had a political position, they would, you know, do some killing, kill themselves and leave a short note saying, I did this because I believe in this. They don't. They write big, long things and post them and send to newspapers and they want to be famous forever. And those kinds of shooters, which we saw here in Oslo, in Norway, and we saw
in Christchurch,
Columbine, in Christ, they become famous in and of themselves, only famous to the subsequent shooters who use them as an excuse to say, I want to be like him. Because think of all that we talked about today and how little we know about him.
Mm-hmm.
He's not famous. How little we know about what led him to this. We just know his randomness of what he chose to do. And also, in fact, how little we all recall about that crime, even though it was the most horrific crime that occurred in modern times. And yet we still don't have all those details in our heads. So his goal of becoming famous, now instead of having an unspectacular life, he's leading an unspectacular life in jail for the rest of his life. Mm. Congratulations.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to know more, Catherine's book, Stop the Killing, is out now. For more details, go to catherineschweit.com. Please consider also supporting our independently made podcast. It's simple to do. Go to patreon.com/stopthekilling. And for as little as the price of a latte a month, you can be part of the solution to stop the killing. Patreon rewards range from official do-gooder status to ad-free episodes, autographed books, and opportunities to connect with us directly for your business, school, church, or even just a book club chat. But just knowing that you are part of a movement that has the power to make your community safer, well, that's got to taste better than a skinny cappuccino any day. So please head to patreon.com/stopthekilling now and polish off your do-gooder halo and make sure to include your name so we can give you a shout out. This podcast is a Conmunity podcast production. That's Con with an N. If you want more content, then head over to Conmunity Podcast at Instagram, where you'll find trailers on more binge-worthy true crime, like the award-winning podcast Conning the Con. And check out our show notes for all the links mentioned. Finally, if you want one takeaway action that you can do right now that can help make our community safer, please share, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen. Everybody needs to know that they hold the keys to see something and say something. Together, we can stop the killing.
It's one of those things you hope never happens, but you better train for it, because it will happen, and it will happen in places you wouldn't expect. Be ready for it.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt Harris. Seton Tucker and I host the podcast Impact of Influence, which for 2 years covered in depth Alec Murdoch, who was eventually convicted in 2023 of murdering his wife Maggie and son Paul. That story continues to evolve, and we will cover that. Plus, we will tell you stories of other true crime events that have happened in the South. Please join us on Impact of Influence and give us a follow on the Impact of Influence Facebook page.